This week we have a follow-up to last week's interview with Sana Mustafa. When I interviewed Sana back in November 2021, we could not have imagined the Ukrainian refugee crisis. So I wanted to hear Sana's perspective as Director of Partnership and Engagement at Asylum Access on the mass migration from Ukraine that's resulted from the Russian invasion, and to understand the broader implications on how the world should deal with this forced displacement and with future mass migrations as climate change really forces people north and south. This is a shorter than normal episode, but Sana's insight and experience makes this well worth a listen. Now, on with the show. Sana, it's great to have you back for a short recap on the Impossible Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. But although your episode just went out recently, it's been a while since we actually recorded it. But as I said, because of my accident, I delayed it. But in the intervening time, lots happened in the world. Obviously, the most notably, the invasion of Ukraine and the massive influx of refugees across Europe. And also, aside from that, there are other things have been happening in the world. And I'm sure you, in your role at Asylum Access, there have been things happening on your side as well. So I think what I wanted to do is get you back on just really to give us an update as to where you are and to get your perspective on how the world deals with, beyond what was happening in 2015, 16, with migrants coming into Europe from Afghanistan, Syria, Middle East, Africa, but now it's coming from Eastern Europe. How does the West, I suppose, rethink and integrate refugees in a way that will lead for a more harmonious society and just, I suppose, generally integrate people into society so that these people can live respectful and humane lives if they decide to stay there? Who knows what's going to happen post the war? Because I know that you're, from your perspective, when we spoke, you don't use the word refugees, you use the word displaced people. Well, the displaced need to find homes. So how do we deal with it? And let's not, I'm not even talking about the food crisis that's probably on the horizon as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, for all these questions. You know, I think forced displacement in general, like, has always been framed as a crisis. And I think the reason is that because a lot of the nation states and the world just refuses to deal with it on a long-term vision and just wants to always, like, every few years when a war erupts or any reason that causes forced displacement for, you know, a big number of population, then we get surprised and we get overwhelmed and we don't know what to do and xenophobia kicks in. So yes, it becomes a crisis. Mm-hmm. So I see, I think the foundation of framing it as a crisis has to do not with the event itself, actually has to do with the way we react to the event. We make it a crisis. And it's fascinating for me, you know, as like a young person relatively, that, you know, for decades, the system has been dealing with it the same way. And still, you know, we're talking about leaders in nation states and that have not really thought about how we can do this differently. And I think Afghanistan recently and Ukraine, where very recent, I mean, Syria continues to be, obviously, and even Venezuelan refugees. But, you know, these, I think, very important examples to look at because they kind of happen at the same time, like with a very, you know, little difference. And the reaction has been extremely different. And I think Ukraine especially reflects that the response to Ukrainian refugees, it should be the response to all refugees.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen a significant difference in the way that...
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think we all... I can mention examples, but I feel this is the most striking thing that has happened, that we all, whether refugees or non-refugees, were surprised by the by the reaction of the global community and Europe and Western countries to Ukrainian refugees, being very open, very welcoming, very receptive, not calling it a crisis. And for us as for me, myself, as a person of forced displacement, as an activist, as a woman of color, and as a human of this world, you know, I have two two feelings about it. The first one, celebratory feeling of like, this is amazing. This is how it should be for everyone. But at the same time, I feel the obligation from my own personal experience and from the justice lens to call out the bias, the structural bias in this response and the structural bias and xenophobia and the whole and the kind of overall system response in general for forced displacement. Because if we, you know, when we talk about structural racism and bias being really the roots of our sector, the forced displacement sector, everyone doesn't want to talk about this and like even would argue against this. But this is really the most recent perfect manifestation of that. Yes, our system is biased. Your responses to Europe's response to forced displacement and refugees and migrants was a racist response for decades. And even right now within the Ukrainian, in people displaced from Ukraine, we know very well, and there's so many documented cases of discrimination against those who are not white with blue eyes, you know, not like you don't have Ukrainian like documents versus, you know, those who are people of color, black.
You mean like students that were studying in different cities that were maybe come from Middle East or Africa.
So I think what I feel here is that we need the system to acknowledge that. We need all of us to acknowledge this bias and this discrimination within the system. And then we need to also acknowledge how amazing this response, this global mobilization on policy and resources level to welcome and actually reduce the trauma of the people we're welcoming into our countries and take this model and be like, this is how it should be with everyone. Why is it not?
So who do you, as an activist, actively working to change the narrative and change perceptions, who are you engaging with around this? Which organizations, international organizations, which countries, you know, how do you sort of create that? How do you use this, as you say, there's a positive because people have been welcomed. They haven't been using the term crisis. How do you use this as a pivot point to realign the way other displaced peoples are viewed and welcomed? Yeah,
that's a very good question. And I think it could be used in multiple ways. The first way is that for a lot of the policymakers and governments where they say we don't have the capacity, we don't have the resources, and we don't have the systems that could take those people in, there's a very good case study. No, you do have it. When you have the political will, you actually do have it. Mm-hmm. And similarly, even my colleagues published an article about using the Ukraine case about the Mexico border and the U.S., because the U.S. made the claim border is that they can't welcome Mexicans and refugees or migrants coming through Mexico to the U.S. because they don't have the capacity and the resources. And now they created a whole separate system to really make sure that Ukrainian and Russian refugees or those who want to seek asylum are welcomed. They have a channel to come to the U.S. through Mexico.
I saw that. That was a real surprise that a lot of Ukrainians are turning up on the on the American southern border, which is incredible.
But that means you actually can do it. You actually have the systems. Yeah. You actually have the resources.
Yeah. Somewhat calling bullshit on the government.
You just don't have the political will. And similarly in Europe and similar with other, even Canada, like and the US offering, you know, certain visas for Ukrainians to come with big numbers, and Europe as well facilitating access to Ukrainian refugees to come and really with dignity to an extent. That's all in evidence that actually can be done. So we can't continue to blame the systems and the lack of resources on our lack of action and political will. The second thing is that it's really kind of the argument of, at this time and age, how are we looking forward as leaders? Like, forced displacement will continue to increase, whether for, you know, violence, wars, or climate change. And this is just a fact. And as the leaders of your countries, if you don't have, you know, you foresee a solution and a way that you actually to not make this a crisis, then we are missing an opportunity here. To really prepare our countries and our policies to welcome people from all around the world. And I think with the increase of nationalism as well and right wing, you are preparing your country for a civil war. You're preparing your country for unrest. if you do not foresee this, if you do not prepare your people for a mindset shift, if you do not work on racism within your own countries, if you do not prepare the systems as well to welcome those people and integrate them. Because to be honest, it's just not a matter of you want to do this or not. It's happening anyway. So how do you want it to be happen? Mm-hmm. And how much you want this to come from leadership position versus unprecedented, and as a result, leading to a further crisis and increasing xenophobia in the country, and eventually leading to unrest of any sort of type.
It is interesting. It made me reflect. I can't remember if we talked about it in the first interview, but I went to the Tenement Museum in New York before I left, and was in the. It's a great museum for people that are going to New York to see how people lived on. Is it Delancey? I think it is. And they've retained the original apartments where people lived. And when they come in as immigrants into New York in the late 1800s. And it's fascinating to see that. And it just made me reflect on how welcoming and how much opportunity there was from people coming from, whether it be Ireland, Eastern Europe, combination of sort of you know, all races, religions, just awash in New York and building their communities, whether it be the Russians in Brighton Beach, and obviously other Eastern Europeans and Poles in the Lower East Side, and Italians and the Chinese, and it's incredible that the country was so open and welcoming, and there was no barriers, and it was a time of opportunity where people's endeavor, hard work, sacrifice, and willingness to endure hardship to build a better life was what accelerated the progress of the US economy, and particularly New York. And now there's this huge opportunity available to countries to seize this as an economic, not just from a sort of what is from a human rights and from a decency standpoint, and from pure humanity, but from a self, if you look at it from a self-interest standpoint, countries have an opportunity to embrace talent, encourage these people to create new homes and new opportunity, and to change the sort of the nature of and the direction of those economies. And I just think it's crazy that what we're seeing is polarization, creating barriers to the embrace of displaced peoples. It's bizarre. Are there any groups or is there a narrative or any organizations that are fighting for that type of policy to see it as an opportunity rather than as a crisis?
To be honest, all organizations around me, most of organizations, I would say, in the sector right now, who fight for asylum, who fight for refugee rights, are making the case around this, utilizing this policy moment of like, it could be done because you just did it. It could be done for others. And so many are doing this, including even funders, actually, in front. A lot of activists, a lot of philanthropic actors and organizations. And I think it's good that we are mobilized on this and continuing to use the moment. I think what's really tricky is that, unfortunately, like all big events, after a while, an event loses its momentum. But I think like for Asylum Access and similar organizations, you know, this is a historic reaction, right? And it's been documented, and we will make sure to continue to use this as an advocacy tool going forward. Every time, you know, we are received with barriers and excuses to not welcome refugees, whether at the US border, whether in Malaysia, whether in Thailand, or whether in Europe as well.
Okay. And what's the latest from on the ground in the Middle East and particularly in Syria? Can you give us an update as to what the,
you know,
happening?
The situation in Syria, where so many people, they think it's over. It's been 11 years. And the situation is really still, is just declining and declining. And as a Syrian myself, who's like in touch with my family very often, I was telling friends the other day, you know, every time it gets worse and, you know, you think it can't get worse and then it gets worse and people adapt. And this is not okay that people adapt. Like my family and other families are adapting into Russian presence all over our lives. I mean, we teach Russian language in schools right now. This is colonization. Wow. In the modern age as
that's
well.
Incredible.
And that's what we continue to say. You know, what's happened in Ukraine in the past few months has been happening in Syria for at least 8 years since recent Russian intervention. And it really, really no one cared. And no one continued to care. It breaks my heart what I see in Ukraine because I know how worse it could get. We've got that, you know, when Russia first intervened, it was certain level of destruction. But now, after 8 years, we're talking about political takeover. We're talking about social takeover. We're talking about war crimes, more than what it's already been done. So I really fear for Ukraine if the world leaders, quote-unquote leaders, don't really act and stop Russia. And I'm afraid of Ukraine will be the next Syria. And in my, you know, political understanding and like political analysis is that obviously Syria was a testing ground for Putin of how much the West will stop Russia from spreading its hegemony. And the West did nothing. And I think maybe they did not think forward about how this could lead to further, you know, invasions. And here we are facing Ukraine. So, you know, as a civilian in many ways, I really wonder of like those in power, how do they not foresee those things? You know, as like I am a civilian, have been able to foresee, and we made this argument as Syrian activists for 10 years to the world leaders in Geneva, in the US, in Europe, being like, if you let Putin go away, you know, like run away with his crimes in Syria and even Iran and China, this is not going to be it. You're going to have, you know, it's going to come to your back door.
Yeah.
And really, no one really understood this or maybe did not have, again, the political will. And there's, you know, geopolitics. So no one really took an action. And here we are again. And the same on forced displacement. It's a lie if anyone tells you it's unprecedented. What's unprecedented about it? We can already foresee 10 more forced displacement crises in the next few years, and we can tell you exactly where would they come from, you know, and climate action activists would tell you exactly where would they come from, and then world leaders would be like, we're surprised. And so I think there is something about not stopping delaying things and dealing with them later, and like us coming together and actually strategizing and working together collectively as a world, as humans of this universe, of how we are going to deal with these issues going forward. Because I, you know, as someone who's now living in the Asian time of, you know, climate change, I am worried for our continuity as a human, you know, as a human race. And I feel, you know, we cannot separate the political events from climate change, right? And so this connection is very important. And I think things need to be done differently this time than it has been done for decades before.
A couple of other questions. In terms of Syria, I'm shocked. I'm surprised that they have such a stranglehold on the country that Russian is being taught in schools. Does that mean that it's mainly? I mean, obviously, Arabic is the primary language, but instead of being English or French, it's Russian as a second language now for children growing up.
Yes, I mean, we continue to teach in schools English and French, which actually only been added like in the last 15 years or something. So not that long ago. But yeah, Russia now is another language we teach it at school, which is very rare because we don't teach other languages usually. It's not like, you know, in the US system where you can choose a language you want to study beside, you know, as your secondary language. There are so many signs in the street. I mean, there are so many signs is who decides in Geneva that first you can understand who's actually in power in Syria, which is Russia. If that's not an indicator, you can go to the country. And there's so many signs in the streets of like Russian and Syrian flags and Putin and Assad pictures next to each other in offices, in government offices, in the streets, you know, economy, there are so many new, you know, what do you, like buildings and like commercial buildings that are really built by Russia and China as well in Syria as a sign of, you know, rebuilding the country. And so, yes, there the signs are not lacking. And anyone who is a little bit following Syria, it's very obvious. And especially those in power from Geneva, they know exactly who they're talking to and who's making decisions. They don't talk to the Syrians, really. They talk to the Russians about Syria, to Iranians about Syria. I'm afraid, you know, I'm not afraid. I mean, I'm positive. If Russia is not stopped in Ukraine, which, you know, we have a past, even between, we have history between Ukraine and Russia, that's very evident of that as well. It will just be the same, if not worse.
Okay. And you mentioned displaced people in other likely hotspots around the world where there will be potential sort of movements of people because of climate change. Which parts of the world are you talking about?
You know, it's funny. I think of Europe a lot, especially now, actually, in light of, I think Ukraine and Europeans did not think like they would have refugees from Europe into Europe. And I think of, you know, in Canada and in the US, in the countries that we don't think of, obviously, like climate change, I think will affect a lot movement and migration. And obviously, the usual suspects of countries in the global majority and the global south, as a result of colonization, as a result of capitalism, as a result of how they have been used, you know, as really kind of labs for so much of the West industries, of course, will continue to face and would be the first probably to face the consequences of climate change. And it's going to be unjust again. The way we deal with it and the resources are going to just reflect injustice in the world again of like, who's going to step up to save those countries versus who has resources and going to step up to save countries in the global north.
Yeah, it's a terrifying prospect. Yes. I mean, you just look at what was happening in Sweden over the weekend with far right groups who were taking very violent action against what they see as the integration of Muslims into the country, and if we think about just the potential sort of migration of peoples in the next 20, 30 years, the risk of social unrest and civil breakdown is terrifying.
Absolutely, I think, you know, so nationalism is the next disease if we don't deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've certainly got your hands full in terms of the task to reframe the narrative and the perceptions of people, both in government and in society generally. So if people want to read more, I think we put links in the show notes before, but if people want to read more or contribute to this this reframing and rethinking of how we think about refugees and displaced peoples, where should they go?
Yes, I can, you know, you can go to asylumaccess.org. We have also unified number of resources on Ukraine action, especially towards supporting organizations that led by locals in Poland and in Ukraine, and also organizations that focus on more marginalized groups, such as people of color, LGBTQ women, amongst that forcibly displaced from Ukraine. And so definitely people could look there. And in general, I think as public, all of us, you know, we have fatigue. I mean, we're all tired. Like COVID is still kind of, you know, in and out, and world crises have not stopped. I mean, ever since I was born myself, and especially in the last year, there so much has been happening. And so it's easy for all of us to feel overwhelmed. And I think it's okay. I feel overwhelmed myself. So I'm always trying to balance between really being aware of my fatigue and like taking care of myself, but also not detaching myself from, or like not stopping to take action on what's happening in the world, because it is really personal for all of us. And no matter how distant you are from forced displacement, it's close. I don't think anyone is distant right now. We're all very close to it. Even if we don't have immediately the lived experience, it's, you know, it's your neighbor, it's in your country, and it's just increasing. And so finding that balance between action and like, you know, self-care, I think it's something I'm trying to navigate, and I kind of would invite everyone to think about it as a question to navigate versus like to not do anything at all.
Okay. And then final question. And how are your family? Have you any news on your father? Are your mother and your sister, are they likely to come to the US?
Yeah, no. No news on my father. My father continues to be forcibly disappeared without any news since July 2nd, 2013. So we are coming up to 9 years anniversary in a few months. And my mother and my sister, my younger, continue to be in Canada waiting for their documents. And my older, the same, who's based in Germany. And unfortunately, you know, we have not seen each other in 3 years due to COVID and due to lack of documents. And herself, my older sister, who's based in Berlin and every day fights for our dad's freedom, has been declined visa by the Canadian government to come and see my mom and my sister and myself. And, you know, it's like we are forbidden by the system from seeing our father, and we are also forbidden by the external system to also come together and reunite. And so, you know, the system is really not built for people like us. Not built for people with no Western documentations, not built with for people who don't have traditional jobs and like, you know, they want like proof of incomes that qualifies for Western countries, not built for people who are not, you know, white. And white means like in privilege and access and resources. And so we're trying to change those systems and we'll continue, you know, to advocate and to speak up. But I have to say it's exhausting. It's exhausting.
Yeah. Well, it's impressive the your will and your energy and your optimism.
I try.
So, thank you. Thank you again,
thank
Sana.
You,
and it was great to catch up with you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, that's all for this week, folks. If you're enjoying the show, please either follow, download, or subscribe on your preferred podcast player. We'd also appreciate a rating and a review as it helps more people find us. And if you have a guest you think we should interview, just email us at info@theimpossiblenetwork.com or message us on Instagram @theimpossiblenetwork. This is a Fabrica Collective production, so have a great week and we'll be back next time with another inspiring guest on The Impossible Network.